The Barclay Enterprise Lecture is held annually in memory of Clifford Barclay, a much respected former governor of the school. The lecturer today is Professor John Kay, who himself has no connection with the school. He was educated at Edinburgh and Oxford, and has made a career elsewhere in London. But in looking at that career, one inevitably feels that that has been the school's loss, and we're very grateful to the Barclay family for making possible his appearance at the school before his eventual return from the metropolis to Oxford, where he has been appointed as director of Oxford School of Management Studies. And he clearly is very good at marketing already from January the 1st. He has also, of course, built his reputation in London by developing the Institute for Fiscal Studies into the serious think tank that we know today, by building up London Economics, the largest independent economic consultancy in Europe, and as director of the Centre for Business Strategy and a professor of economics at the London Business School. His books on tax, on industrial economics and business strategy are well known, as are his columns in the Daily Telegraph or latterly in the Financial Times. His subject today is the stakeholder society. What is its true meaning?
Thank you, Les. There are several ways in which this lecture seems to me today particularly appropriate. Firstly, it's a great pleasure for me to be giving a lecture which is in honour of Clifford Barclay. I remember meeting Clifford Barclay 20 years ago when I was a young lecturer at Oxford, and actually it was Clifford's Trust who gave what I think was possibly the first small research grant I ever received in my career. I can still remember actually meeting him in one of these ways that visual images somehow stick in the memory. I have a curious memory of sitting with him in a restaurant in Edgware Road, as a matter of fact 100 yards or so from where I now live. And I remember, as one does sometimes remember these things, him urging me to have the Vichy Soise and saying, "It's delicious, you will enjoy it, but I'm too old to have these things now." And actually, there's something in that which is about the way in which, as people get older, as people like Clifford get older, they get pleasure from the achievements and opportunities for people that they give to people younger than themselves. And indeed, this lecture, I think, is about remembering that, because there were two institutions to which Clifford was committed in this sense. One was the London School of Economics, with which, as Les has pointed out, I have no connection other than this lecture. But the other, of course, is Oxford University, where Clifford's aspiration was to establish a world-class management school, and he made the first substantial donation towards that. And it is therefore very appropriate that I should both be giving this lecture tonight and, as Les has described, going back in January in order to run that school. The second way in which this lecture is appropriate, perhaps in a way that one hadn't expected, and this comes back to the issue of the pleasure people take from the achievements of those they've helped. There's no one, I think, of whom that is more true than Jim Merlies. And those of us, like me, who were students of Jim Merlies, were thrilled earlier this week to learn about his Nobel Prize for Economics. When I first met Jim in Oxford more than 20 years ago, he explained to me that what he was working on then was imperfect economies. And I have to say I didn't quite understand what he meant when he said that. There was an awful lot he said that I didn't quite understand what he meant the first time he said it. But over the subsequent 10, 15, 20 years, I discovered what exactly he did mean by imperfect economies. It's that, of course, which was the basis of the Nobel Prize, which was awarded to him this week. But it's also actually what is going to form the basis of what I'm going to have to say tonight, because my subject tonight is the political economy of imperfect economies. And what I'm going to talk about is the implications of some of that analysis in which Jim Merlies has played such an important part. It's the implications of some of that analysis for our political economy. So that is going to be my subject, and stakeholding, having been in my title, the word stakeholding is going to be mentioned as often in the course of this talk as it was by Tony Blair in his speech to the Labour Party conference last week. But nevertheless, I hope you will get out of this some idea of what a new centre-left political economy might actually look like. Because we all know that if we're talking about political economy, about the way in which economics relates to political issues, then we're talking about an agenda and a debate which for the last 100 years has been essentially dominated by socialism. The interesting thing is that that language of socialism, the polarization which is created around it, has actually dominated the dialogue not just of people who were in favor of it, but equally of people who were against it. And it's only really in the last decade, or perhaps 2 decades, that that has changed, and much of what is said about political economy is no longer about socialism, that the intellectual leadership in this sort of area, as it were, has been taken by what it's customary now to call the language and the dialogue of the new right. We all know what the doctrines of the new right are, and they're a pretty unappealing bunch, as a matter of fact, both personally and doctrinally. The most important of social institutions is private property. Self-interest is the central human emotion. Economic insecurity is a necessary, indeed essential, engine of progress. Government is inherently coercive or corrupt. And what we mean by fairness and justice is basically defined by respect for other people's property. I'm not going to devote my lecture this evening to answering that kind of dialogue and that kind of and to criticizing that kind of analysis, although the criticisms of it will be implicit in what I do have to say. What I intend to say tonight is instead intended for the people who have already, at least intuitively and instinctively, rejected that kind of doctrine, to people who are rather unattracted by a society which is based on greedy executives maximizing shareholder value, people who have a suspicion that nursing might be more important than Eurobond trading, even if it's not paid as well, people who have a sense that what is valuable in society is very largely derived from the relationships with other people, and people who would like to be told that they can believe in market efficiency and that markets actually have an important part to play in human life and yet believe in these kind of things. It's these people to whom I'm addressing what I'm going to have to say tonight. Because what I want to do is to try and offer them an opportunity to make that intuition coherent and to make it consistent with much of what we've learned about the efficiency and effectiveness of market economies. So that's my subject. The main doctrine which exists today, I think, for people who want to take that kind of view is something which I'm going tonight to call redistributive market liberalism. And what redistributive market liberalism is perhaps best defined as something which we might call Arrow de Brewer plus Rawls. When I say it's Arrow de Brewer plus Rawls, I mean it starts from what those of us who are economists know as the fundamental theorems of welfare economics and the kind of models of general equilibrium which go along with that. The kind of models in which we have profit, utility maximizing individuals with well-defined preferences who come into the world with established endowments and seek to maximize on the basis of that. That's a model which is adopted by the people I've been describing on the new right. It's also right who find it particularly convenient, because for certain forms of conservatives, there's actually a wonderful coincidence between that economic model and a conservative approach that says justice basically involves respect for private property. That is, Nozick tells us that the outcome of free market is just, and Arrow and De Bruyer tell us that it's efficient, and that coincidence is, in a sense, the basis of New Right doctrine. Arrow De Bruyer plus Rawls, the liberal market redistributive position, you know, broadly accepts that model of how markets operate, but actually takes a rather different view of distributive justice. That's redistributive market liberalism. And it's well described, I think, in term by authors like James Mead and Samuel Britton. And I think what are the content of it is well encapsulated in the titles of two of their books, Efficiency, Equality, and the Ownership of Property, or Capitalism with a Human Face. Capitalism with a Human Face, I think, poses it particularly well. Because what these people are suggesting is basically that there is a dichotomy in the way in which we view the economy and society. Essentially a dichotomy between the way we view the economy and society. That is, in the redistributive market liberals' position, distribution is a matter of civic obligation, while production and exchange are matters for private profit. Self-interest is something which should dominate our commercial life, while welfare is essentially the subject of political action. Fairness and justice are things which are aspects of our social behaviour, but they're not aspects which are relevant to our business decisions. And basically, the state should play a central role in determining the distribution of income, but should, as far as possible, leave the activities of production and exchange to the operation of private agents and the free market. So that the market liberal state is a state which is concerned with distribution, but which is engaged only in minimal interference in the functioning and operation of markets. And the market liberal believes that state action in economic regulation should, in the main, be confined to dealing with a small number of targeted market failures. Market failures that arise from the presence of monopoly, the existence of externalities, certain kinds of systemic risks of the kind that exist in the financial system, or the kind of market failures that arise from asymmetries of information. State intervention in the economy should be targeted on these limited group of market failures. And that's basically the redistributive market liberal position. I've already described some of its most eloquent expositors as being James Mead and Samuel Britton. And 10 years ago, at least, largely under their influence, I would have described myself as a redistributive market liberal. So what you're hearing tonight, when I withdraw from that position, is in a very real sense, and in a very personal sense for me, a recantation of a position which I would have once have taken up. So what I want to start by doing now is explaining why I think it is that redistributive market liberalism fails, that capitalism with a human face is not a viable doctrine or a viable description of how markets actually operate. And I want to focus on three broad groups of reasons why redistributive market liberalism fails. The first of these is that what I've just described as the dichotomy between the moral attitudes that underpin our business behavior and the moral attitudes which we adopt when we take on civic obligations, that dichotomy is actually unsustainable. That it's really very difficult to be a sort of selfish beast at work and a concerned citizen at home. Impossible to have one set of attitudes in the boardroom and a different set of attitudes in the ballot box. If we look at the way someone like Samuel Britton expresses this kind of thing, What he says is that in matters such as buying and selling, or in deciding what and how to produce, we will do others more good if we behave as if we are following our self-interest rather than by pursuing more altruistic purposes. That quotation is actually so important to Britain that it appears three different times in the course of his book, Capitalism with a Human Face. You'll see that what it's suggesting is that not only are we have almost a moral obligation to behave selfishly in relation to our business behaviour. That is, even if we would like to behave altruistically, it's our job, indeed our duty, to restrain these kind of altruistic impulses. Well, it's possible to do that, I suppose, but difficult. But Britain quite quickly modifies what he says, in that soon after that you find people should be allowed to follow their self-interest and the market, in the market, and should not feel guilty in doing so. It's a slightly more moderate statement of the same kind of position. But you can see that what's happening here is that this initial moral position is gradually being eroded. And in truth, that statement, people should be allowed to follow their self-interest in the market and should not feel guilty in doing so, is for me uncannily similar to this particular statement, which comes from the great American arbitrageur, Ivan Boesky. And what Boesky said was, greed is all right, by the way. I want you to know that. I think greed is healthy. You can be greedy and still feel good about yourself. I don't know whether Mr. Boesky is still feeling good about himself. It's perhaps unnecessary to add that his commercial career came to an end when he was sent to prison. And it's perhaps also unnecessary to add that Eurobond traders rarely leave the trading floor early in order to go home and do good works. Or that the policy issue, which seems of main concern and most pressing concern to senior executives, is actually the disincentive effects on effort, presumably their effort, of high rates of taxation. What is bluntly the case is that this kind of behavior in our commercial life is corrosive of more altruistic attitudes in our commercial life as well, in our civic life as well. The dichotomy which this kind of morality puts up between our commercial behavior and our civic behavior is unsustainable. One has to conclude, I think, with a slightly different quote, which is 300 years old, from Mandeville's famous fable of the bees, when he expressed deep skepticism about all this in describing a world in which every part was full of vice, but the whole was an earthly paradise. The dichotomy, in short, is unsustainable. The dichotomy which is at the heart of what I'm calling redistributive market liberalism. There's a second reason why redistributive market liberalism fails. And that reason is that the Arrow-Debreu assumptions actually very largely fail. Now, all of us have done basic economics, know the familiar reasons why Arrow-Debreu assumptions fail. The ones I described earlier, to do with market failures of various kinds, to do with externalities, public goods, and the like. But we've now understood, and this comes back particularly to the work of Merlies and other applied welfare economists over the last 20 years, that kind of model of the economy actually fails to describe real economies for a much wider range of reasons as well, and that many of the difficult assumptions about that Arrow-Debreu model are actually assumptions which are implicit in it rather than explicit. And perhaps the most important of these assumptions are to do with commodity homogeneity. That is, that commodities, the ones over which people have well-defined endowments and well-defined preferences, commodities are not homogeneous. In modern economies, commodities are mostly pretty complicated. They have multiple dimensions, they have many characteristics, and it's quite hard to tell what these characteristics are. And the result of that is we're typically operating in imperfect markets in which people who are selling know a great deal more about the characteristics of what they're selling than do people who buy. So that information asymmetry is a fundamental problem of modern economies, and we see a whole variety of social mechanisms that grow up to deal with these problems. These Aryadhibra assumptions also fail because small group interactions, and this is something we've learned from game theory, very often have what one might think of as pathological properties, that people fail to achieve outcomes which it would be in everyone's best interest to achieve. And that we've learned from the kind of games that are described as prisoner's dilemmas, as chicken games, as battle of the sexes games, the problems that have to do with coordination, differentiation, and cooperation. Unmodified individualistic outcomes often fail to produce these necessary requirements. And there's another reason why this kind of model doesn't actually describe real economies, which is that the way it deals with risk is to assume that we can trade any kind of risk in real markets, but actually very few markets for risk actually exist. In fact, if you think of the main economic risks that individuals face, you point to the risks associated with redundancy, with marriage breakdown, and with small business failure, all substantial economic risks that fall on individuals and can't be insured or diversified for reasons which I don't have to spell out in any detail. And if you ask how markets deal with these, they don't. Typically, if they're dealt with at all in modern societies, they're dealt with by mechanisms of social insurance, that is, benefit systems and structures provided by the state, or by virtue of sharing between individuals and groups and communities. What will be clear from what I've been saying is if you recognize these problems of differences in information, of the problems of small group interactions, of the absence of widespread markets in risk bearing, we see a whole variety of social institutions that have grown up in order to help us cope with these economic problems, the ones which arise from the failure of our basic models to describe adequately the operation of these economies. And market economies, far from being based on aggressive individualism, would not work effectively if we did not have that kind of social context and these kinds of social institutions. So my second reason why redistributive market liberalism fails is that these Aryadhibra assumptions don't actually adequately apply. But there's a third and perhaps most fundamental reason still why it is that redistributive market liberalism fails, and that is the failure of its assumption that we arrive in the world with well-defined sets of property rights. All of this is predicated on the basis that we all have clear and well-defined claims to private property. Indeed, most people, including again myself until very recently, would have said that private property was the fundamental institution of a capitalist society. I want to ask you to think about that issue for a moment, because I want you to ask you to think about a typical day's transactions and ask what role private property rights play in relation to these transactions. You start by going to work on the tube, for example. What are the property rights which are involved in that? Who owns London Underground? Well, if you go into it, the technical answer is that London Underground is operated. It's not entirely clear who it's owned by. It's operated by a body called London Underground Limited. London Underground Limited appears to be a body which has a single shareholder, the Secretary of State for the Environment, whose name is Mr. John Selwyn Gummer. And he owns, or he probably owns, the London Underground. The reason you pay a fare when you get on the Underground is not anything Mr. Gummer does to exercise his ownership rights. It's actually that there's a large turnstile there to stop you getting in without paying a fare. That turnstile is erected under the London Underground Act, and you can operate the London Underground, and you can obtain such a ticket by paying a fare. If you buy the ticket for some bizarre reason, as you'll notice if you look on the back, it says this ticket remains the property of London Underground Limited. So you don't acquire property rights in the ticket. You may acquire property rights in some sense in the right to use the London Underground by virtue of buying the ticket, but it's better to say that what you acquire, insofar as it's a right at all, is a right to travel from A to B without being subject to a penalty fare as a result of paying for this particular ticket. Then you have a day, then you go, you start your day's work, and I suppose you can describe that transaction as one in which at the beginning of the day you own your labour, and by the end of the day you've transferred ownership of your labour to your employer. But it actually seems to me a pretty peculiar way of describing the transaction that actually takes place. Having done your day's work, you go out for a beer in the pub. Well, think about that transaction for a moment. You buy a glass of beer, and that confers on you ownership rights in the beer, but not in the glass. Nobody tells you that, but you're expected to know that. And then if you sit down at a table in the pub, you will discover that you are entitled to sit at that table so long as you consume a reasonable quantity of alcohol or some other refreshment while you're actually sitting there. Again, nobody tells you that either. It's simply a convention that surrounds the transaction. And finally, having got home, you then turn on the television. And what you do when you turn on the television is you confer, is you set in train a variety of rights and obligations. You're obliged to buy a television license. Someone else will pay a certain amount to the performers by virtue of you watching it, etc. The point I want to make is firstly that property rights, the kind of transaction involved in the exchange of the apples from my garden, from the pears from your garden, actually play very little role in describing or defining these kind of transactions, so that property rights aren't central to this description. Indeed, the property rights involved are often very largely unclear or very largely invented, and that the whole set of transactions in which we engage is in fact surrounded by an elaborate structure of social conventions. So that property rights are not things that were determined by nature, they're actually artificial social constructs. Now, once we've said that property rights are social and legal artifacts, rather than being things that simply were defined, determined by nature, we have changed the nature of the issue and the argument really quite dramatically. We're no longer in the world in which Nozick and his conservatives occupied, in which literally they define the natural method of obtaining property rights as being one in which you pick up seashells from a seashore on which even after you've picked up your shelves, there are many left for other people. None of the property rights involved in the transactions I've described were of that kind. If you want to see the extent to which we're actually in the process of inventing property rights, you might think, for example, of a recent somewhat egregious case in which a woman was awarded $3 million in a US court because she scalded herself by spilling a cup of too hot McDonald's coffee over herself. Now, what the courts did was actually to determine the property rights involved in that particular transaction, inferring into the contract a term beyond the simple exchange of a dollar for coffee, in which one was entitled to buy not just coffee, but property which was being sold at a coffee which was served at a particular temperature. Now, the courts might have been right or they might have been wrong in defining the property rights involved in that transaction in that particular way. But I ask you to notice two features of it. Firstly, that the property rights were being defined by the court. That is, they were not natural. They were not obvious. They were invented. And secondly, that in making that decision about the property rights, it's hard to believe that the jury was not influenced by the knowledge that the woman who had scalded herself with the McDonald's coffee didn't have any money, and McDonald's had rather a lot of money. In other words, we're working back from the outcome of these particular property rights to the definition of property rights themselves. And before you think, as you might be inclined to think, that it's clearly inadmissible that we should do that, Notice that that is what was actually happening all the time in relation to the transactions I was describing earlier. That the so-called property rights in relation to the London Underground journey were not, as it were, natural, externally defined rights. They were rights which were defined by legislation in an attempt to create an environment which was fair as between the people who did use the London Underground and the people who didn't. And the intellectual property rights, for example, which were set in train when I watched television, were of exactly the same kind. These are not natural property rights. They're property rights which are invented by law in order to create a particular desired result. So that property rights are not exogenous. It is not the case that we arrive in the world with a well-defined, explained set of property rights. And if that's the case, it blows a rather large hole in, I think, in the world which looks, the position that looks at both economics and politics on the basis of exchange based on a well-defined set of initial property rights. What I'm arguing is that once our property rights are seen as social and legal artifacts, our criteria of justice and efficiency necessarily relate to the definition of property rights themselves and are not just concerned, can't just be concerned with the distribution of property rights. But as soon as we've acknowledged that, then I think we have to understand that our market economics is actually heavily embedded in a social context. And once our market economics is heavily embedded in a social context, for all the reasons I've described, the failure of these Arrow de Breux assumptions, the importance of information, brand signaling, reputation that arise in relation to that, the sharing of risk informally among groups as well as through formal insurance contracts, the ways in which conventional behavior grows up in order to deal with the kinds of social interactions which are characterized by the prisoner's dilemma. As soon as all these things happen, we start to realize that none of the things we think about in our economic models as exogenous are really so. They're all products of a market which is embedded in a social context. And in truth, if we think about this at an empirical rather than a theoretical level, we all know that that is really true. If you ask what are the fundamental reasons why Japan and the United States and Switzerland are rich, and why, on the other hand, Haiti and Nigeria and India are poor, the reasons have very little to do with differences in the resource endowments which these countries enjoy, and almost everything to do with the social context within which these different market systems operate. So our market economics is necessarily massively embedded in a social context. And once we've recognized that, we ought to see also that the moral philosophy which is relevant to market economics is not actually the moral philosophy of liberal individualism. It's actually the moral philosophy which has been developed over the last 20 years, come to be labeled communitarianism, although practically everyone who is called a communitarian author hesitates or tries to deny that they should be properly associated with that label. But I'm talking about the kind of moral philosophy that over the last couple of decades has been developed in contrast to the liberal individualism of people like Nozick and Rawls, some of them conservatives, some of them liberals, but all of them in this liberal individualist tradition, the kind of communitarian moral philosophy that has been developed by people like McIntyre, Taylor, Unger, and Sandel. If one asks what the key communitarian assertions are, they start just as I've been talking about an embedded market, a market which is embedded in a social context. They talk, and this is Sandel's phrase, about the embedded self. What they mean by that is that we are fundamentally and essentially social creatures, social animals, and we don't have concepts of justice, rationality, or indeed preferences, which are formed independently of the social environment within which we operate. They will go on to argue that Hume's classic distinction between is and ought statements is actually very hard to sustain because we have very little conception of what is that is derived of what ought, which is derived independently of what is. And they will argue too that very few of us behave as maximizing individuals in the way in which we're described as doing in the models I've described, that the best way of describing what most of us both do and ought to, and you'll notice again that that distinction has largely collapsed, what we both do and ought to do is to pursue some sort of conception of a good life, which will, to be sure, have a substantial element of self-interest in it, but will also contain elements of other things, like fulfillment, success, respect of others, and so on. So we're moving away from that simple, crude model of utilitarian maximization to a broader conception of what it is people do. An Aristotelian eudaimonia, which I was pleased to discover is not actually a new product for cleaning your sink, but is actually a Greek word which is often translated as happiness, but actually embodies these other elements of it which I've been describing. These are the sort of basic assertions of this kind of communitarian moral philosophy. And the intriguing thing for me in reading that was to discover the more or less universal hostility of people who wrote in that kind of vein to modern economics and modern economists, because they assumed the necessary tie-up between neoclassical economics and liberal individualism, which is the sort of moral philosophy they were actually railing against. But what follows from my argument is to say that actually that kind of moral philosophy fits more naturally with a sophisticated understanding of how it is that markets work than does the model which is based on liberal individualism. So I'm describing, in effect, the interaction between an embedded market on the one hand and an embedded self on the other, and arguing that in both our commercial behavior and our moral and social behavior, we operate and can only operate effectively by virtue of the conventions and styles and behavior and history of the society within which we operate. And you can see we've moved a long way from the dichotomy which I was describing earlier and attributing to people like Mead, Britain, and indeed to this dominant school of redistributive market liberalism, in which there's a sharp distinction between the way we behave in our business life, our economic life, and the way in which we behave when we take on our civic obligations. Now let me go on from there to notice that perhaps the most potent criticism of this kind of communitarian approach to justice, rationality, and fairness is the kind of criticism which worries about the very fundamental moral relativism which is at the basis of this. Part of the reason why communitarianism became unfashionable and why liberal individualism has been so dominant for decades since the war is some fears as to where certain kinds of communitarianism historically led. That is, we know that we don't want to find ourselves in the position of having to judge Nazi Germany by reference to its own values. But yet that's a position to which moral relativism tends to drive one. Nor do I think we want to neglect the feminist critique of that kind of position, which says that most societies for most of history have actually pushed woman into a various kinds of subservient role, and people would like some sort of framework that enables them to say that that was wrong, or at any rate currently inappropriate. I want to offer two partial answers to that. One is to say that nothing I've said requires our moral relativism to be absolute. That is, that it may be it's possible for us to make criticisms of Nazi Germany other than the fact that the Nazis lost the war, didn't they? Although I'm going on to say that the fact that the Nazis lost the war is in itself quite a powerful criticism, you know, of that particular value system. And by that I don't just mean that we would think their value system was a good one if the weather had been slightly different at Stalingrad in the winter of 1942, but rather that that was a society whose values were intrinsically bound to mean that that society failed, as it ultimately so dramatically did. So that what I'm arguing, and this comes from giving an economic dimension to the kind of thinking which I've been describing, is to say that processes of competition and natural selection actually offer us a partial answer to this kind of critique that worries about our inability to criticize values from a framework of moral relativism. That is, that the criticism of societies which limited the role of women is to say that in the long run, they were not that successful even at achieving what were the objectives of their own values, and they manifestly imposed substantial economic costs on themselves. That what we see is a competition between alternative value systems and a competitive process among not just economic but social and political values, in which it's manifestly the case that certain kinds of value systems, in particular value systems that embrace substantial elements of liberalism and pluralism, actually emerge more successfully than others, not just in terms of their economic success, but in terms of satisfying a whole wide variety of other needs which they have as well. The kind of Fukuyama argument which notes the dominating, increasingly dominant power of liberal democracy is actually very relevant to that kind of argument. And indeed, if we look back and see what has happened over the last two centuries, we see ourselves in a position in which there was developed in Western Europe in the roughly the 18th century a social context which was actually particularly favorable to economic growth and economic development, and the prosperity and progress of our regimes has been essentially a measure of that. So what I'm trying to do in this argument is to say that the kind of insights which Schumpeter had when he regarded competition as a matter which affected political systems and political values, as well as competition occurring between economic systems and firms, is actually relevant to putting the totality of this argument together. What I've been saying so far has actually, in many ways, been rather theoretical, and I've ranged over both economic theory and some moral philosophy in order to try and put together the arguments which I've been presenting. I want to take the last few minutes I have tonight to ask whether this matters. That is, if one takes the kind of view I've been presenting, rather than the views of the redistributive market liberals, what does this actually mean in terms of the kind of practical policy choices one might want to make? And I want to note the differences which arise in two particular areas, one of those which have to do with welfare policy, and the other of those which have to do with the management of economic regulation. As far as welfare policy is concerned, what those who take the redistributive market liberal position have tried to do has been essentially to invent a language of welfare rights. They create new rights which are of the kind everyone has a right to an income which is one-third of national average earnings, or everybody, even disabled people, have a right to get on a number 27 bus. The rather fundamental problem, in my view, which welfare rights encounter, is it's not very clear what gives these rights a status that enable you to assert them unambiguously in favor of a conservative position which simply denies that such rights exist. What, in effect, the redistributive market liberals have been doing in this area has been seeking to attach to property rights welfare claims, believing that by doing so they will give the same kind of status to welfare claims that property rights themselves enjoy in the new right or the individualistic liberal framework. But if you take my position, which says that actually the basis of these property rights themselves are rather shaky, and that they're the product not of people discovering seashells on the seashore, but rather of artificial social constructs, you can also, I think, see that attaching them to property rights weakens rather than strengthens the basis of these kind of claims. But that's the sort of approach which leads redistributive market liberals to want to assert welfare entitlement in terms of some basic entitlements. That's why I've cited Mead and Britton as classic redistributive market liberals, and both of them have devoted large amounts of their time to developing schemes for citizens' incomes or social dividends or basic universal citizens' claims of that particular kind. My social market approach actually comes at this issue from a very different perspective. That is, where it looks at welfare is by starting with an emphasis not on the liberal individualist right to autonomy, but on the social market emphasis on inclusion. And the status of welfare is actually as people's rights to be included, and I'd rather not frame it as rights, people's expectations of being included in the society of which they form part. And at that point, with that emphasis on inclusion, one starts to see, for example, that what we want to confer on people who don't have jobs is not entitlements to compensation for not having a job, it is jobs, because we regard work and earnings as central social values of the society in which we live. And as a pluralistic society, we may not want to oppress people who, as it were, choose to opt out of that particular system and structure, but we have no strong feeling of obligation towards them either. Equally, when we come to contemplate pensions, you know, we regard people's position in old age as essentially that of a claim which people have at the end of their working lifetimes by virtue of being included in society. And we regard provision of old age as a matter for that claim rather than as an opportunity for individuals to make savings as provision for their own retirement. Our approach to welfare, in short, is based on considerations of inclusion rather than on the liberal individualistic framework of rights and claims. So that these are the differences in the way in which redistributive market liberals and social market economists would approach these welfare issues. And I think they involve very fundamental differences in the kind of unemployment benefit one would structure. One is led to want to have, as it were, back-to-work welfare-type benefits in the social market framework in a way which one doesn't in the liberal individualistic framework. One is led to look at people's claims in retirement in a very different kind of, and this here in the social market context, universalist framework rather than a liberal individualistic one. Second area I'd like to point out differences to is in relation to the ways in which we formulate economic regulation. For the redistributive market liberal, the way in which we look at this is by reference to what we call what people often call the umpire state. The job of the government is to lay down a framework, and then people pursue their own self-interest within that. So, for example, the way we regulate utilities is we set price caps for them, and we then allow them to go away and make as large profits as they like, or indeed pay themselves as large salaries as they like, within the framework which has been defined of price cap regulation. And if we discover that the framework doesn't work quite as we meant it to do, and we discover in general that it doesn't, what we need to do is to elaborate the framework so that it has that desired effect. What we have some difficulty in understanding, I think, is that this is, as it were, the right-wing version of the same left-wing fallacy that was at the center of the failures of socialist planning. If that kind of system would have worked, then Gosplan, you know, would have worked as well, because it was predicated on the same structure and it actually collapsed in the same way. Because what happened in relation to central planning in these command economies was that you attempted to lay down from Moscow frameworks of rules within which people could operate, despite their rather different motives and information. You typically discover that that never quite worked in the way you meant it to do, so what you did was to send out a different control framework, a more elaborate set of directives from Moscow, only to find that that process repeated itself until you ended up with a framework which combined being very complicated with not being very effective. And in this rule-driven system of economic regulation, I believe we can already see that we're going down precisely that same route. The social market approach to this kind of regulation is to say that what we actually want to do is to regulate by values as far as possible, rather than to regulate by rules. What we want to do to our water businesses is not to say, within this rather elaborate framework we've laid down for you, go away and make as much profit as you can, but rather to say what we want you to do is to deliver relatively cheap and good quality water supplies to people in an efficient manner. That's what we expect you to do, and we will come back at some time and see how well we've done it. What we're doing is internalizing within this social framework the process of economic regulation as far as possible within the behavior of firms themselves. And I said I wasn't going to say very much about that word stakeholding in the course of this evening, but you'll see in at this point how much this argument relates to that stakeholding view of the corporation. So if the two alternative, as it were, center-left political economies which we have available to us today are redistributive market liberalism and what I've called the social market implies different results and different kinds of policies in a wide variety of areas. So let me try and sum up what it is that I've been saying in the course of the evening. First of all, I've argued that concepts of distributive justice, the goals of individuals, these are all things that are determined by the values of the society within which we live. They're not things that come to us known and fixed from outside. That's, as it were, the embedded self. I've also argued that property rights and individual preferences are equally not things which are defined outside our social system. They're social constructs which are derived from within it. Alongside that embedded self, we actually have this socially embedded market. And finally, I've argued that competition between value systems is a central instrument of social and economic progress. That when we think about the merits of competition and rivalry, which are the central reasons why market systems have proved so effective relative to centrally planned economy, so we should understand that that process of competition is something which is as true of political structures and social value systems as it is of firms and economic systems. Let me say a last few words, which is that people like Adam Smith and Hayek are today the unread gurus of the new right. They're unread because I think if you look back in what both of these authors wrote, you will discover a great deal in what they wrote that is rather close to what I've been saying tonight, and a good deal less that favors the aggressive liberal individualistic position, which I've caricatured as the new right, and which others have developed as what I've called redistributive market liberalism. Actually, there's a good deal in both Smith and Hayek that would be consonant with what it is that I've had to say today. I'm not sure how many of the people who proclaim Adam Smith as the great founder of markets based on aggressive individualism realize that Smith's great philosophical work, his theory of moral sentiments, was one in which he argued that what he called sympathy was essentially the basis of moral sentiments. What I've tried to suggest tonight is that there is no inconsistency between that concept of sympathy and the ways in which market economies actually operate in practice. Thank you very much.
We have just 5 minutes for questions.
I mean, I think the two issues there, the first is that the term social market has been sort of widely used, and it's clearly widely used to mean many different things. I think most of the people who I've called redistributive market liberals would in fact see themselves as adherents of the social market. What I've tried to do is adopt a rather narrower and perhaps rather different definition of the social market. I'm not sure it's anybody else's definition of the social market. I adopted that term with some reluctance towards the end of what I had to say, mainly because I needed some term, and even if it has been used by other people, this one is the most appropriate one. But to go back to the substantive point you made, I hoped I made it clear that I encountered great difficulty with the concept of welfare rights. I don't see where a firm basis for so-called welfare rights could actually be found. And I argued that the way in which welfare rights had entered our dialogue, was that people who wished to make these claims using the language of liberal market, of redistributive market liberals, had essentially attempted to tie welfare claims onto property rights. Given the thrust of my argument, which was to say that I regard property rights as themselves artificial social constructs rather than external entitlements, you'll see how unconvincing a basis I find the language of welfare rights as a basis for welfare claims. Right, I wouldn't claim it's a new idea. I doubt if I would claim that anything I've said in the course of this evening is a new idea. One's tilling a field in which there are really very few, absolutely new and original things to be said. What I am saying is that notion that property rights are endogenous is one which has not been typically reflected in the ways in which we, and I'm including myself as a sort of market economist, have typically talked about the ways in which market economies operate, and that we look at a variety of issues rather differently if we recognize that.
One last question.
I'd like to go further on competition between value systems.
Right. I understand why people like Alber are saying what they are saying in that context, and it is making a very important point, which is to say that the capital market system, which has been associated with the most individualistic end of the spectrum we're describing, essentially that Anglo-American model of how capital markets work, because it is a more efficient model of capital, a more efficient capital market structure, is actually demonstrably tending to drive out other capital markets throughout the world. And that's a process which we see happening at the moment, and it's the process which people like Alber, I think, quite rightly warn us about. I think the competitive process which I see at work is actually a rather longer term one than that. And I believe, although it may take us some considerable time to realize that, that the disadvantages of that particular capital market structure are such that in the end we will wish to restrain both the operation of capital markets and competition between capital markets in such a way as to ensure that that Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-American model of how capital markets work is not, in fact, the only or the dominant market model throughout the world. Because in a broader competition perspective, that model is actually inferior rather than superior. It's only superior judged by the criteria of the capital market alone itself, which is indeed, what people like Michel are.
Moral philosophy. Perhaps we should have more of them, as we did in the days of Adam Smith, or at least as economics did in the days of Adam Smith. The relevance to politics of what John has said is clear. If we try to assert the value of markets, as all politicians are now anxious to do, do we have to go along with liberal individualism? And we've had a fresh answer tonight. It's clear that Clifford Barclay's small grant, when John was a young researcher, has borne ample fruit, and we will no doubt be hearing more from him as he preaches to managers at Oxford. Thank you very much.